Mexico City, a month later, today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. A month ago, a deadly earthquake hit the Mexican capital. Hundreds of buildings were damaged or destroyed, including the one where The World's Monica Campbell used to live. She's still looking for answers.
So you wouldn't have lived in the building I lived in?
No, I wouldn't.
I made a mistake.
I think so, but I mean, this is a problem. What means did you have to know that you trusted the government?
Plus, the battle against ISIS hits young women especially hard.
There is this generation of girls that has seen their dreams really be crushed in the wake of years of fighting.
Those stories today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. What a couple of months for disasters, fires in California and Europe, hurricanes and floods across the South, the Caribbean, India, and Bangladesh, even a tropical storm in Ireland. Major damage everywhere, some places like the island of Barbuda completely destroyed, Puerto Rico struggling to get back on its feet, and let's not forget the back-to-back earthquakes in Mexico. The second of those two quakes hit Mexico City and surrounding areas exactly 1 month ago today, which is where we raise the curtain on the show today. The World's Monica Campbell lived in a part of the city hard hit by the quake, and she's been trying to get answers to questions a lot of people have been asking now. Questions like, how can people live safely in Mexico City, or any city prone to earthquakes, for that matter? And what can we learn from Mexico and how people responded?
September 19th. I was in the Boston newsroom that afternoon, far from my home in Mexico City, my family, my one-year-old son. I watched footage of collapsed buildings. I couldn't believe it. The quake struck 32 years to the day since the massive 1985 quake here.
8.1 earthquake hits a population of 15 million.
That time, at least 10,000 people died. Fewer people died this time, 369 people confirmed dead, fewer buildings collapsed. Some say it's because this quake was weaker, that building codes had improved, or that it was just plain luck. When I got home to Mexico City, I saw our community ripped apart. It's what natural disasters do. People were evacuating, moving, in my building too.
Everyone is moving pretty rapidly because this building is on the high-risk list, which means get what you want quickly out of here and get out.
Walls had fallen. There were holes and big cracks floor to ceiling. An elderly woman walked down the stairs and prayed, carrying a box of photographs, weeping. One family, close friends of ours, is leaving the city altogether. They lost their home and jobs in the quake and had to find work elsewhere. Gabby Luan, the mom, tells me she could never live in this building again.
No podemos estar aquí. A componer el edificio, a remodelarlo y todo, para ellos todo va a seguir.
The memories of the quake, this building, are too disturbing.
Y ella empezó a gritar que mi mamá, mi mamá.
She says, my daughter was screaming, mom, mom. It's etched in my mind forever, she says. We say goodbye, and my family goes to stay with friends who offered their homes. Disasters split communities, but can strengthen them too. A week later, though, I see what happens after a disaster like this, when people worry about which buildings are safe, which should be demolished. And here's where things get tricky. Instead of having city inspectors, Mexico City outsources inspections to private engineers. They decide on repairs, whether a building is safe, not the city. Also, the engineers are paid by building owners or developers. I see this process up close in our own building. A private engineer, Jose Gongora, was hired to inspect the building. A group of people who own apartments here follow him, and it becomes clear how interests can clash. The inspector says the building isn't bad. He's not worried. It'll need plenty of repairs, new walls, but it'll be fine. One apartment owner has doubts, though. She mentions that an architect told her the building was tilting, that the building next door slams into ours during quakes. Another engineer who'd come by said a column was badly damaged, and that worried her.
Nosotros vivimos aquí, entonces tenemos que asegurarnos. O sea, porque nuestra vida corre peligro.
The apartment owner says, we live here. We have to make sure this building will be okay. She tries asking more questions, but other apartment owners who don't live in the building themselves cut her off. They ask the inspector to wrap it up, declare the building safe. This back and forth between building owners, private engineers, competing interests, some say it's a flawed, dangerous process, that the government isn't taking public safety seriously.
The reality is that the city plays no role. The city has abandoned its role, and I think that's a mistake.
Mario Ordaz is an earthquake engineering expert at the National University of Mexico.
Determining whether a building should be demolished or not should not be left to the opinion of private citizens.
Do you think that there will be buildings left alone and people will go back and live in these buildings that you think should actually be demolished?
Definitely. That's going to happen.
I asked him about my building. Would he have lived in it? It was built in the 70s, and everyone said, hey, it survived the big 85 quake, so it's solid. Professor Ordaz shakes his head. So you wouldn't have lived in the building I lived in?
No, I wouldn't.
I made a mistake.
I think so, but I mean, this is a problem. What means did you have to know that? You trusted the government. You trusted the fact that if that building was there for rent, you assumed that it was suitable for that.
Ordaz also worries that without earthquake retrofitting, which isn't required in Mexico, these buildings, like mine, may collapse in another similar quake. City and federal officials would not grant interviews to talk about these safety concerns, despite repeated requests. These worries become very real when I follow a civil engineer, Araceli Arenas, to inspect other buildings. She's part of a brigade of volunteer engineers going through the city post-quake. At one point, we go into a building and see something disturbing. An extra floor of apartments being built on top of an old building. There's a rush to build in this neighborhood. It's gentrified. People will pay high rents. Arenas questions the architect, asks for his license, permit. She says the construction looks shabby, not something that seems authorized.
Es construcción nueva. No hay ningún problema. Simplemente nosotros tenemos un
nivel. This person is not happy that we're here.
No hay ningún problema que lo estés haciendo, o sea, no pasa nada.
He tries to block her way, but eventually lets her in. After, Arenas tells me how dangerous illegal construction can be.
Sí, es peligroso porque no sabemos, bueno, si sabemos que el...
She says how that extra floor could cause the whole building to collapse in the next quake. After this quake, investigations are making this horribly clear. Investigations of building violations are now happening throughout Mexico City and other areas hit by recent quakes. There's a probe into construction irregularities involving a school that crashed, killing 26 people, many children. All of this sounds familiar to Marco Rascón. He's kind of a legend in Mexico City. Some call him Super Barrio for this caped lucha libre superhero character he created after the earthquake in 1985, pushing for tenants' rights, the right to live in safe buildings. Rascón is older now, 64, and runs a seafood restaurant, and says he hopes this earthquake generates more change. He's encouraged by the rush of volunteers to help.
Era la misma sociedad otra vez.
He says society, the same people came out again. It's therapeutic to help clear the rubble, feel useful, instead of looking up at the sky and thinking, what next? And after we talk, he wants to show me something that gives him hope. He takes me to this big garden across the street, blocks of palm trees, ivy, a mini jungle in the city. Beautiful. I'd walked by it before, but never gone inside. He tells me what was here before.
Estaban los edificios del multifamiliar Juárez que se derrumbaron
An apartment complex fell here in the 1985 quake. More than 200 people died. The space was abandoned for decades, filled with rats, until it was reborn as this community garden. Tomatoes, chilies,
albahaca,
basil. And hours after the recent quake, it became a major donation center. It's been a month since the quake, and my partner, Eric, my baby boy, and I, we've been sharing a home with another displaced family. It's been really sweet to see the kids play together, but we miss our old home. I check in with Gabby Lujan, my neighbor from the beginning of the story, who left the city with her family. Gabby. ¿Cómo estás? Gabby feels more relaxed now, even though she's still in an earthquake zone in southern Mexico, Oaxaca. It got rocked by a quake last month, too. At least 100 people died. But Gabby says she feels safer. All the buildings are one story where she lives. No tall buildings falling down. She asks, what's our plan? We're moving to California, the Bay Area, another quake zone. I tell her how there was a big quake there in 1989.
Candy Maldonado with the hesitation.
Game 3 of the World Series. San Francisco Giants versus the Oakland A's.
Dave Parker at second base, so the Oakland A's take.
I'll tell you what, we're having an earthquake.
A magnitude 6.9 quake, strong enough to break the Bay Bridge. But that was 1989, a long time to get complacent, forget the fear. We're determined not to do that and keep asking the same questions in the U.S. as in Mexico. For the world, Monica Campbell, Mexico City.
Well, we still have a couple of minutes before we take a quick break. Just enough time to note a speech today by former President George W. Bush. He hasn't given many speeches since leaving office, but today Bush 43 was in New York City for a Bush Institute event, and his speech seemed to be a rebuttal of sorts to President Trump's America First mantra, though Bush never mentioned Trump by name. Instead, he spoke about the need for America to lead in a world where democracy is under threat like never before. He noted external threats like terrorism, nuclear proliferation, and Russian cyber meddling, but Bush also talked about internal threats to democracy.
We've seen nationalism distorted into nativism. We've forgotten the dynamism that immigration has always brought to America. We see a fading confidence in the value of free markets and international trade, forgetting that conflict, instability, and poverty follow in the wake of protectionism. We've seen the return of isolationist sentiments, forgetting that American security is directly threatened by the chaos and despair of distant places where threats such as terrorism, infectious disease, criminal gangs, and drug trafficking tend to emerge.
Bush said America must continue to be a global leader on behalf of democracy and that the strength of American democracy begins at home with a fundamental respect for America's core values.
We become the heirs of James Madison by understanding the genius and values of the U.S. Constitution. We become the heirs of Martin Luther King Jr. by recognizing one another not by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. This means that people of every race, religion, ethnicity can be fully and equally American. It means that bigotry or white supremacy in any form is blasphemy against the American creed.
A couple of passages from a rare speech today by former President George W. Bush in New York City. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Syria was once home to a highly educated middle class. Books were an important part of the culture, and literacy was highly valued. But the country's six-year war has endangered all of that, especially for young Syrian girls. That's what journalist Gail Tsimak-Lamone found out recently when she visited the Syrian town of Tabqa, just outside of Raqqa. She was struck by the story of a 16-year-old there named Bushra.
She is this incredible young woman, you know, with just very bright eyes and a great sense of humor, living with her extended family of about 20 in a bombed out office building. She was a girl who had been in school. She had finished ninth grade and the war came and her family left Aleppo, looked for safety in Raqqa. and ended up marrying her off like so many girls she knew. And she said to me, you know, every girl I knew was either kidnapped or gone missing or married off. And it's really devastating because here you're talking to a 16-year-old girl with a 2-year-old and a 9-month-old. And she said, you know, now my dreams are all for my children. You know, what was really striking, Marco, is that she did the interview with us in plain sight of her husband and her extended family. And what she said has stayed with me because I said, do you talk to any of your friends? And she said, no, we're all scattered, all my schoolmates. And she said, but I'm one of the lucky ones because I actually like my husband.
So this is not just one or two cases. I mean, it sounds like this is a case for a lot of young girls there.
Absolutely. And it's an underreported story. You know, you talk to these young women, girls 15, 16, 17, and they will all tell you that, you know, almost everybody they know is either married or missing or was injured or killed in the war, that there is this generation of girls that has seen their dreams really be crushed in the wake of years of fighting.
So, as you say, the logic for the parents who do this, they're protecting their daughters by having them married off. Describe the parents for us. Do they see the dilemma, or was this a natural decision for many of them?
And there has always been early marriage in the Middle East. But in Syria in particular, education levels were very high. Girls were in school. But when war comes, parents look to figure out how to keep their children safe. And for girls, a lot of parents see marriage as a way to put them in an extended family that keeps them more secure and safer than they could keep them and keeps them fed. And, you know, what you see in terms of paying the price is young lives, right, that will never be the same. A whole generation of smart, educated young people who are really now trying to survive and rebuild their lives on the ash heap of war.
What about other girls? Do they continue pursuing their dreams?
You know, there's one 13-year-old girl who I just keep thinking about from Raqqa. And I met her in a camp for displaced people just outside Raqqa. And she's hasn't been in school in 5 years. And she came up to me and she was really shy. And it's hard to find girls that age to interview because oftentimes families will keep them very close for safety. And so I said to her, you know, tell me about yourself. What do you want to do? And she said, all I want to do is be back in a classroom. And I said, okay, well, what subject? And she looked at me and said, oh, I don't care. Whatever subject it is. Wow. You know, I just want to be back studying. And at the end of the day, and we were leaving at the end of several hours of doing interviews and talking to people. And she said, you know, I wish you would come every day. And it just, yeah, it stays with you.
I mean, it strikes me, too, that trauma shadows them constantly. Who can they talk to when they need to unload? Is that like even in their mindset?
That is the biggest question. And it's one that is seen as, you know, lower on the needs of folks who've been displaced or folks who've been refugees and returning home. And yet it is so urgent. What struck me is that I don't know when the last time anybody asked this young woman what she wanted or how she was feeling or what she wanted to study, because her family's been struggling to survive years of civil war and ISIS rule. You know, and that whole piece about trauma and how you move forward, I don't know where these girls are going to go to have somebody just listen.
This visit to Topkapi seems like it had a really big impact on you and the girls you met. What else really stuck with you from what you saw?
The strength and the courage of the mothers we met stays with me. And I think about it all the time, whether it's Bushra, who is 16 and a mother of two, or another mother we met in Raqqa, who walked out of Raqqa City braving ISIS snipers and the threat of coalition airstrikes seeking to dislodge ISIS snipers, 8 months pregnant, and led her 2-year-old daughter and her mentally ill husband out of the city amid all of this, snipers and airstrikes. And she gave birth in the camp for displaced people in Ain Issa outside Raqqa. And she was so strong and so articulate in talking to us about the future she wants for her daughters and how she wants it to be different. And you know, you hear young people say, our generation is lost, but everything now is for the next generation.
Incredible. Gail Samak-Lamon, she recently visited the Syrian town of Tabqa, just outside of Raqqa. Gail, thank you very much for telling us about this.
Great to join you.
Gail's trip to Syria was supported by the Pulitzer Center for Crisis Reporting. Speaking with her today reminded us of a conversation we had last year with another young Syrian. His name is Abdul Kafi Alhamdo. He spoke with us from Aleppo during the brutal siege there. And as we spoke, Abdul held his infant daughter, Lamar, in his lap while bombs fell all around their apartment. Abdul Kafi and his family now live in the Syrian province of Idlib. We reached out to them via WhatsApp today.
I hope that Lamar will be an educated woman, that she can study what she wants, of course, what she loves to study in the future. But the important thing for her, that what I want for her, not to think only for herself. No, I want her to think of the world, and she's an important part of this world. Because this is what I believe, what I hope for the future of Syria to be. So I hope Lamar in the future will help other people who suffered. We felt abandoned for years. A lot of people let us down. I want my daughter Lamar to help those people and don't let them feel that way that we felt. Yes, this is what I hope in the future for the coming generation, and especially for my daughter Lamar.
Syrian English teacher Abdul Kafi Alhamdo speaking with us from Idlib province in Syria. Okay, let's preview for you tomorrow's special edition of The World. We'll be devoting the show to stories about sexual harassment in the workplace. Stories from all over the globe, because as you'll hear, it's not just Harvey Weinstein, and it's not just in America.
From what I understand, I was the only one who got the sex stuff.
One of our guests tomorrow is Catherine Borrell. She worked as a radio producer in Canada, and she was targeted and harassed at work on a daily basis.
I was the lucky one, you know, who got all the stuff where he touched my body, or he would bring me into the soundproof studio and grab my ass and say that he couldn't control himself because of my skirt.
Her harasser was Gian Gomeshi, former host of the CBC radio program Q. Catherine says her coworkers were aware of what was happening, but no one spoke up, and that this is common when confronting harassment.
You know, these predators are really good at forging intimacies with people that seem as though they are consensual when they are really not, because of the inherent power dynamic.
She took it to her managers at the CBC and to her union, but that didn't help. Eventually, though, she was heard. We'll hear the whole story tomorrow on a special edition of The World. My co-host will be Jasmine Garst of our Across Women's Lives desk. Find out how you can be a part of our coverage tomorrow on Facebook. Just search for Across Women's Lives. Today's top news headlines are up next here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. Coming up on The World, a French singer gets lyrical about candy bars, fruit, and the future.
If you plant a Twix in the ground, you won't get anything. If you plant an apple in the ground, you can feed the world.
A, shall we say, wide-ranging conversation with Camille. That's still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. It's called the windscreen phenomenon in the UK. Call it the windshield phenomenon here. You're driving down a country road at night, and when you get to your destination, there are bugs all over your windshield. If it seems like that is happening less and less, maybe you're just not driving on the right roads. But there is a new study that suggests another possibility, that there's been a drop in the number of flying insects. Researchers found that more than three-quarters of the flying insects in nature preserves across Germany have disappeared over the past three decades. Biologist Dave Golson is one of them. Dave, we've heard a lot about honeybees dying, butterflies disappearing. What's different about this study?
This one is a bit more dramatic in that it's all insects, all flying insects anyway, which is most insects. It's not just one species. It seems like there's basically a kind of wholesale collapse of wild insects, which we should be really worried about.
I mean, three quarters of the flying insects in Germany, that sounds really bad. Do we know why this is happening?
We don't know for sure. We can take a kind of educated guess. The studies were done on little nature reserves. They tend to be kind of islands surrounded by farmland. And I think it's likely that it's how the surrounding land is being managed, because the nature reserves themselves haven't really changed. But the surrounding landscape is full of these big kind of monoculture crops treated with lots of insecticides. And flying insects, obviously, nobody can tell them to stay on the nature reserve. You know, you'd be okay if you don't leave. And so they fly about and they leave the nature reserve. And I think they just don't often come back. Most of the landscape is essentially kind of hostile.
And what would you say is the connection between these big monoculture farms and the disappearing insects?
There are lots of aspects to it, but essentially, if you're any kind of insect or really any kind of wildlife, there isn't much for you in a modern farm. You know, there's just a big field of wheat or barley or corn or whatever it might be. There are virtually no weeds, so there are no little flowers around the edges. If you do find anything to eat, it's probably been contaminated with a whole bunch of pesticides, including some really potent insecticides that are used these days. So we've turned a huge proportion of the surface of the world into a fairly bleak and inhospitable place for life other than the crop.
Is there a connection to climate change at all?
We don't think so. We spent ages analyzing these data with respect to weather patterns to see if that explained what was going on. And it does explain kind of year to year variation in numbers. You know, some years are warmer than others and better for bugs than others. But it doesn't explain at all the long-term trend, this three-quarter of insects disappearing.
So when there are fewer bugs, I know a lot of people might see that as good news, but explain why it is not.
Yeah, it makes me really sad when people think that the disappearance of our bugs is a good thing. Obviously, some are pests, some are mosquitoes or crop pests or whatever. But the vast majority of insects are benign. They do all sorts of really vitally important things. Actually, they make up about 2/3 of all life on Earth. They pollinate about 3/4 of the crops we grow. They're food for most birds and lizards and amphibians and bats and so on. So if we were to lose the insects, we would lose most of our crops, we would lose all the flowers from the countryside, and we'd lose most of the bird life, the mammal life, and so on. So essentially, we're talking about complete catastrophe for life on Earth.
Yeah, it would be essentially impossible to live on planet Earth without insects, it sounds like.
Absolutely.
The study measured the biomass of flying insects trapped at more than 60 nature preserves, but just nature preserves in Germany. Is this likely to be happening in other parts of the world?
So far as we know, there's no reason why this should be just happening in Germany. The way we farm is very similar everywhere else. So my guess is this is happening everywhere.
So what is the big takeaway for you and your colleagues after this research?
I hope that this is sufficiently dramatic that people will sit up and listen and realize that actually we are doing irrevocable damage to the Earth's environment and we can't carry on. We really need to start changing our ways and look after the planet better.
On a personal level, does that mean just, you know, trying to find your local farmer's market?
That's a good start. You don't use pesticides. Try and grow your own food, buy organic food, local farmers. Yeah, exactly. If we all did that, the world would be a much better place. Eat a little bit less meat, too.
Dave Goulson, thanks very much for your time.
My pleasure.
Dave Goulson is a biology professor at the University of Sussex and co-author of a new study in the online journal PLOS One, documenting massive insect die-offs in Germany. Now to a story about a billionaire businessman turned politician. He's won over voters by denouncing the political establishment and pledged to run his country like a business. Yeah, I know what you're thinking, but it's not him. The man at the center of this story is Andrej Babiš. He's poised to become the next prime minister of the Czech Republic and to further shake up European politics. My BBC colleague Rob Cameron has been following the lead up to this election. He told us about Babiš from outside a cafe in Prague.
He's a very, very rich businessman. He's the second richest man in the country. He owns a huge empire of food and fertilizer businesses. He owns bakeries. He owns meat processing plants. He also owns the country's two leading daily newspapers and a TV station. So he's a very powerful man. He's a man who only entered politics a few years ago as finance minister.
Yeah, so he wants to drain the swamp. He wants to run his country like a business. How does he feel about immigration?
He is very hostile to immigration, especially Muslim migrants. He opposes the European Union's scheme of compulsory quotas for relocating migrants. But frankly, there is no mainstream politician in the Czech Republic anymore who supports the EU's migrant quota scheme.
Tell us about the party he started. What's it called?
The party he started is called Ano 2011. Now, Ano is the Czech word for yes, and it also means the Association of Independent Citizens. All the opinion polls suggest will emerge as the biggest party in parliament this weekend.
Right. And he's had some stained time in that government. Tell us about his legal troubles and his political history, because I'd like to know if you think other lawmakers in the Czech Republic would want to partner with him.
Well, that's the big question. He was fired essentially by the prime minister after he was formally charged with fraudulently attempting to obtain EU funds for a large farm and conference center that he owns outside Prague. Now, he dismisses those allegations, but essentially they did cost him his job as finance minister. He was forced to step down. There's also a separate investigation being conducted by the European Union's anti-fraud office. But for him, really, it damages his coalition potential.
So, Rob, let's step back for a second, because a rise of nationalist leaders has been seen in France, the Netherlands, Austria, Hungary, some with more success than others. But this is the trend we've seen play out in Europe in the last year or so. And we've seen voters, like here in the U.S., who are done with traditional parties and want populist anti-establishment alternatives like Babish. Can you situate what a victory for Babish would mean in relation to the rest of Europe?
Well, that's a very difficult question. There are some who see what's going on in this country, in the Czech Republic, as a continuation of a great schism between Western Europe and Eastern Europe, with the rise of far more autocratic, authoritarian, nativist governments in Poland and Hungary. And they say that, yes, well, the same thing. Look, it's clearly happening in Slovakia and the Czech Republic. I think it's not quite that simple, really, because the Czech Republic, unlike those countries, still has a very healthy civil society, still has, you know, a lively independent media. Also, it will depend a lot on what kind of coalition Mr. Babiš forms, if he does win the elections and if he's given the chance to form that coalition.
So come Monday, if Babiš is victorious, would you see the headline more as major discontent among voters in the Czech Republic, or would you see the headline as another nationalist domino has fallen?
I think the former. I think it would be more discontent. But I think the headline for me is, why are Czechs so discontent? That's something that has many people, journalists like myself, just scratching their heads. This country, not just in Prague, but beyond it, has very high standard of living. It has, you know, great growth figures. The economy is in good shape. The economy is now in surplus. It's really an economic success story. Unemployment is incredibly low. And yet, people seem incredibly frustrated and unhappy. It seems that people have the cars, and I'm looking at them now, driving past me. They have the phones, they have the clothes, there's food on the table. And yet there is this great feeling of discontent, even anger on social networks, on Facebook and so on, that really the sources of that are very hard to fathom.
The BBC's Prague correspondent, Rob Cameron, just outside a cafe in Prague. Thanks very much for your time, Rob.
Thank you.
As the Czechs get ready to vote this weekend, tensions are coming to a head in Spain. On Saturday, Spain's central government says it's going to start the process to suspend the regional autonomy of Catalonia. You will recall the controversial referendum there earlier this month, followed by threats from Catalan leaders that they just split off from Spain. It's been ugly between Madrid and Barcelona, and it could get uglier still. We want to step back and learn more about the roots of this dispute. The World's History guy Chris Wolf is here to help. First of all, Chris, why is this all coming to a head now between Catalans and the Spanish government?
Well, there's a host of factors dividing the Catalans from the rest of Spain, you know, from economics to taxes to questions of pride and dignity. But I think the driving force is at its root this conflicting sense of identity, which is primarily about language and history. And the language, I think people need to know, is very different. It's as different as, say, Dutch from German or French from Italian. A lot of Spanish people have been led to believe that it's just a bad dialect of Spanish, but it's not. It has its own distinct history. And, you know, I can tell you myself, you just drive across the frontier into the Catalan region and my Spanish is good enough to get by in a grocery store, and you look around a supermarket and suddenly you can't understand any of the labels.
So they've got their own language, but as part of the geographical territory of Spain, I mean, that's been the case for centuries, right?
Well, yes, but it was never always a happy marriage. And the key point for Catalans is that before that, for hundreds of years, as part of the Kingdom of Aragon, they were their own rich and powerful state from about the 800s to the 1400s. So ancient history for Americans, but the, you know, Europeans like to keep their grievances alive. Now, Aragon, including Catalonia, was a strong commercial power like Genoa and Venice, and they were very similar, prosperous, cosmopolitan merchant states with naval power and an empire that spread across Sardinia, Sicily, even Athens for a while.
And Barcelona was always the center of that power?
Correct. And Castile, on the other hand, you know, the main heartland of Spain, was the land of poor, proud, stubborn, agricultural, like warrior crusaders. Mm. You think of the man from La Mancha. So you couldn't get two more distinct cultures.
So how did Catalonia lose its independence?
Well, they would claim they didn't. They would say actually they were united with Spain through marriage, literally in the person of Ferdinand of Aragon and Isabel of Castile, the same two monarchs who gave us Christopher Columbus mm-hmm. and destroyed the last Muslim emirate in the south of Spain. But this is hard for modern age people to get their heads around. But in those days when two kingdoms were united with the same monarch didn't necessarily mean the governments were integrated. And Aragon, Catalonia kept their own laws, parliaments and institutions for like another 2.5 centuries. It was only in 1714, relatively recent for European standards, mm-hmm. that a new dynasty came in and just started to bring the hammer down the Catalans. To be fair, that was after about 75 years of on-again, off-again revolts by the Catalans.
But the Catalan identity persisted.
It did. It lost its prestige until the 19th century when Spain is on the decline and Catalans have this renaissance in literary terms and in terms of their own national pride and identity.
I'm curious, Chris, under the terrible rule of Franco, what was Catalonia's status?
Well, it was not good. To help listeners along, let's remember that there was a brutal civil war in Spain between leftists and fascists, and most of the regional minorities in Spain took the side of the leftists.
Including Catalonia.
Including Catalonia. And after the war, Franco brought the hammer down really hard on all the minorities. Languages weren't allowed to be used in school. Folk dancing was banned. The only official dancing allowed was flamenco. You know, it was pretty intense. And Catalan did suffer a lot of damage in that time, because if you go there today, all the kids have to learn Catalan. It's the only language allowed in school. And yet, if you go into the playgrounds, they're generally speaking Spanish in Barcelona. But you've got to remember, it was during Franco's period that this is when these Castilians got this sense of Catalan as being Spanish light or something like that. Mm. And the age of discrimination really riled the Catalans and still rankles with them.
That history, that culture, that's not going anywhere. That identity seems pretty much set in cement. What happens next then?
Well, it's hard to imagine either side like taking up arms and there being a new civil war. But it is quite conceivable that Madrid will move to strip Catalonia of its autonomous powers. And a boisterous city like Barcelona is not going to take that lying down. You can imagine there being some pretty rowdy civil unrest. But that's just me crystal ball gazing.
The World's History Guy, Chris Wolf, thanks very much for this.
You're welcome, Marco.
Here is a hot music tip for you. If you don't know her yet, this is French singer Camille.
La sauce, si la sauce, si les sables, lance la sauce, la sauce, si le aussi, elle la sauce, oh, elle soline,
Camille, or Camille, as we pronounce it in English, is super well known in France. Her latest album, titled We, debuted at number one on the charts there, and now it's out here in the U.S. Calling your album We will make the title accessible for a lot of American listeners, and I think the way you play, just like sonically, means that non-French speakers will enjoy the textures of this music. As for the language, there was one review, one reviewer said that the CD is a celebration of a vocal instrument with wordplay at a premium. And there's one song in French where there's a choral riff in English that goes, plant an apple, plant an apple. What are English speakers to make of these plays on words? Should we just enjoy the rhythm, the texture? Is there meaning?
I always have in mind that music is much more than about the meaning of the words. Of course, my words have a meaning, but even for a French person, they sound musical. I really work on the way French language sounds. To me, words are a lot about vibration. And therefore, even if you don't understand the meaning, their vibration should touch you.
Let's talk about the vibrations and sounds that you were feeling and hearing on this album, We, because you spent almost a year in a 14th century monastery that has become an artist retreat to write these songs, to record some of them. What did the acoustics do to the direction you took these songs in?
I had a room for drums and lead vocals in that monastery. And then I recorded the classical choir that I sang myself, layer by layer, in a chapel. And that monastery has definitely has an impact on the vibration of the album, because it's a place full of light and full of life. And at the same time, it's very ancient. So it's a very deep and powerful place in the south of France.
The song Lasso, we opened with the drums. They set this very basic pattern. Your voice kind of follows this chant-like melody. It feels like it comes from ancient Corsica or something, and yet it's also very modern. Was that idea in your mind before you got to the monastery, or did the monastery prompt new ideas about music?
I really felt like making an album which mixed space and time. And I feel we're at the moment in human history that is both about collapsing and rebuilding. So I really had the intention to mix both primitive sounds, traditional music, classical music, and something very modern, electronic and organic, to express what I feel about the period I'm living in.
It's a weird period, isn't it? Collapsing and
weird, yeah.
And expanding,
weird
and
fascinating, and I feel very privileged. Sometimes I feel unlucky, and sometimes I feel very privileged to live now.
Oh, that's interesting, because a lot of people feel, I think, there's a sense of doom or dread about living right now. But you feel privileged.
I feel privileged because the world and nature is telling us to reinvent the way we live.
There's one song on We called Twix. Is it about the chocolate bar?
It's definitely about the chocolate bar. I'm saying if you plant a Twix in the ground, you won't get anything. If you plant an apple in the ground, you can feed the world.
I was struck by this song, and I'll tell you why. Your subdued voice breaks out into this guttural cry near the end, while your melodic voice kind of gets eclipsed. And I was thinking of Yoko Ono, and I would love to hear a French singer give us a renewed appreciation of Yoko Ono, who really gets so much grief for so many absurd reasons.
All voices are welcome in this world, you know. All experiments, I can't criticize anyone's voice, because people's voice are their soul. So how can you criticize one's soul? She's a brilliant woman. And many people have told me, you know, my record is called Oui, which means yes in French. And some people told me an anecdote about her and John Lennon. The day John Lennon was discovering one of her piece of art, which was, I think, you had to climb a ladder, and then on the ceiling, in small letters, there was this word, yes, written.
Hmm.
You know, but you just
interesting
had to
parallel.
Climb in. Yes, basically that was the story, so.
Camille, let's go out with Seeds. It's the only song on the album in English. It starts with this military drum beat that then reappears, but it also takes off and kind of floats with you asking a series of questions directed to the listener. Seeds, how can you buy them? How can you serve them? How can you trade them? Just tell me why you wrote Seeds, and what does it say about you as a songwriter?
I wrote Seeds because I'm very concerned by the way we grow what we eat and the way we consider life. So I wrote that song because I can see some people are, like me, amazed by the magic of life, and other people are trying to control life, control seeds.
I got to say, I thought the meaning was going to be more symbolic, but you take it straight on, seeds in the literal sense and what they mean to us on this planet.
Yeah, it's literal sense, and the way nature goes should lead us and not make us scared.
Seeds of love, seeds of lettuce, seeds of rust and leaves and flowers, seeds of rain.
Camille, the new album is called We. Thanks very much. Great to meet you.
Thank you. Great to meet you too.
Fields forever, seeds of grace. Seeds of peaches, seeds of weakness, seeds of peace, seeds of hope. Seeds of pace, pine to pepper, seeds of glory, seeds of gold. How can you sell? How can you spoil?
Camille brings our show to a close today. A reminder about tomorrow's show, we're devoting the entire program to sexual harassment in the workplace, the international workplace. The Harvey Weinstein scandal has sparked a global conversation, and we're going to hear what that sounds like in places like France and Nigeria and Canada and unpack the scandal as only we at The World know how. My co-host tomorrow, The World's Own Jasmine Garz from our Across Women's Lives desk. Some seriously compelling discussions, and you won't want to miss it. From the Nana Bill Harris Studios at WGBH here in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. Thank you for being with us.
PRI, Public Radio International.